My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. There is no silence to be broken on the occupation. Book review for the Tel Aviv Review of Books, Spring 2022. The publication of the book, Who Do You Think You Are? By Yuli Novak, is evidence once more that the artistic bar for anti-Zionist creation is low. The book is badly written, the metaphors worn out, descriptions of nature as stand-ins for emotional turmoil, comparing volcanic eruptions to her turmoil, geological changes to social ones, comparing getting lost and found while traveling to getting lost and found emotionally, present throughout, would barely cut it as a high school writing exercise. But because the book tells the story of how Zionism is so irredeemable that it must be scrapped altogether, the low literary value of the book is ignored. Given that the book peddles a recent incarnation of the ancient idea that no amount of reform could make the collective Jew palatable, there is a thriving and stable market for material that caters to it. Who Do You Think You Are? Is part biography, part political reflection, part coming-of-age story. Unfortunately, though, there is no coming of age. The protagonist begins and ends the story as the same petulant child whose so-called reflections lead her to realize that the world is to blame and everyone but her is blind, numb, fearful, and angry. A vein of irresponsibility runs through the book. The protagonist just happens to do things. By her own description, Novak became director of Breaking the Silence, an organization devoted to ending Israel's military occupation of the West Bank on a lark. She was studying to be a lawyer, but didn't want to be one and hadn't yet figured out what she wanted to do. She came across a job ad for director of Breaking the Silence and thought it was something worth trying. Why? Not clear. Once at the job, she doesn't understand why people get angry. Israeli Jews who respond to Palestinian attacks with hysteria and are manipulated by politicians into fear and hatred are at fault. She and her colleagues merely want to highlight the inherent immorality of the occupation. The fury against her is because she stood up against the regime. The forces that oppose her are nefarious and anti-democratic. They target breaking the silence to promote an illiberal order and concentration of powers by the government. Her intentions have always been nothing but good. Oh, and the media is at fault. Theoretically, bad writing and childish protagonists could still make smart arguments. Alas, not in this book. Even if judging only on substance, each of the author's premises is wrong. The first is that Jewish citizens of Israel do not know what is involved in exercising military control over Palestinians in the West Bank, the occupation. If they knew, they would end it. Therefore, there is a need to break the silence surrounding the occupation. This is a tantalizing idea. It appeals to the human desire to uncover dark secrets lurking beneath the surface. It lures people with the promise that they will hear something they have not heard before. It also confers a halo of martyrdom on those willing to break the so-called silence. If only. The last thing surrounding Israel's military control of the West Bank since 1967 is silence. From the moment Israel's military has come to control the West Bank, area captured from the Kingdom of Jordan, following King Hussein's ill-fated decision to follow the charismatic Nasser into that disastrous war, there has been nothing but noise about it. Articles, interviews, reports, commentaries, documentaries, photos, video footage, movies, political debates, UN resolutions, international pronouncements, NGOs, movements, posts, tweets, memes, Jews, Arabs, Muslim, Israeli, Palestinians, Westerners, non-Westerners, academics, celebrities, all weighed in. Perhaps in a small village in China, there is a person who has not had something to say about Israel's occupation of the West Bank. There is no silence to be broken. The occupation does not take place in a distant location. Israelis encounter it in numerous ways, not least of which is service in the military. Almost all of Israel's non-Haredi Jewish citizens serve in the military. Almost all of those who serve or have served in Israel's military had to contribute to maintaining that military control, from intelligence gathering to incarceration to boots on the ground. Israelis who serve in the military talk. Israeli Jews and Arabs are not known for their reticence in use of words. Israelis know what is involved in maintaining the occupation. Israeli ignorance is not the problem. The first and major premise of who do you think you are and of the entire efforts of breaking the silence's effort is that what allows the occupation to persist is the public silence around how it's carried out and its ethical and moral implications. This, by virtue of simple observation, is wrong. Well then, if Israelis know about the occupation and what is involved in its maintenance, and there is no need to break a non-existing silence around it, why don't they just end it? And if not now, when are they going to end it? According to the political rationale of breaking the silence, as explained by Novak, a straight line goes from Israelis hearing the stories of soldiers serving in the West Bank to realizing the inherent immorality of the occupation and wanting to end it. There are two binary alternatives, the immoral choice of continuing the occupation or the moral choice of ending it. Like her colleagues across the Atlantic at If Not Now, an American organization nominally calling for ending Israel's military occupation, Novak wants Israel to just end the occupation. Sure, how? Unfortunately, missing from the entire book is any serious consideration of policy alternatives and their attendant risks. Could it just be that, given all the bad choices, Israeli Jews understand that maintaining the occupation is a dirty business, but rationally consider it, oh, the horror, the least bad of their real-world alternatives? But no, not for Novak this worldly business of choosing among several bad real-world alternatives. Presenting choices that are not black and white, good and evil, moral and immoral, seems to be outside Novak's interests. Whether ideas like Goodman's reduction of conflict or decoupling the necessity of the military occupation as long as the Palestinian war with the State of Israel continues from the question of unnecessary settlements, which this author champions, is not even discussed. Most problematic, the possibility that, despite multiple efforts, Israel has not been able to end its military control of the West Bank through an agreement is because Palestinians refuse to sign any agreement that is not effectively from the river to the sea is never even considered. Novak continues a long tradition of viewing the conflict through the prism of Jewish agency and Palestinian passivity. Jews are perpetrators. Palestinians are victims. Jews act. Palestinians respond. Jews provoke. Palestinians are provoked. The notion that Palestinians carry out deliberate acts against Jews in Israel to realize a clearly articulated vision of from the river to the sea is nowhere to be found, except, ironically, in Palestinian expressions available everywhere, except in Novak's book. Who do you think you are? Partakes in this neocolonial vision that deprives Palestinians of agency. The entire conversation takes place in the author's head between different Israeli points of view. Worse, The entire book centers around the author's feelings about morality. She felt breaking the silence was the moral thing to do. And then it didn't work out anymore. It was too difficult. It was in my head. Something was broken inside me, and I didn't know what. I couldn't anymore. It was too much responsibility, too much fear, too much loneliness. It just didn't feel right. To Novak, everything is binary. She believed lies. Now she knows the truth. Zionists favor the state. She favors the individual. There is nothing in between. No nuance, no sophistication of thought. She was part of a matrix of Zionism that could only be sustained by denial and avoidance. Now she clearly sees that it is a lie, that a sovereign Jewish state could exist without the occupation. Why? She just feels it. When Novak fought only against the occupation and not against Jewish self-determination altogether, she was part of the system. Now she bears responsibility for its inherent immorality. Novak mindlessly adopts fashionable ideas about whiteness and colonialism that could only take place when one is deprived of any historical understanding of the Jewish people. She claims Israel is not like South Africa, only to immediately make that comparison. Novak's ahistorical attitude is obvious throughout as she speaks of fighting the occupation because it's happening now, and who cares how we got here? The desire for moral purity and resolution of the inherent contradictions of Zionism is another aspect of the petulance of the protagonist. It is a desire present as much among Western Jews as among some Israeli Jews of the left to achieve moral purity through powerlessness. It is the Jewish idea that my colleague Shani Moore calls the last time Jews behaved morally was at the lines to the gas showers at Auschwitz. It is a desire to free the Jewish soul from the Jewish body, to forgo the messy, moral, earthy life of Zionism for the moral purity of Jewish powerlessness. For some Jews like Novak, the inherent contradiction they cannot sustain is not left-wing Zionism or even Zionism itself, but the very idea of Jewish power. What Novak seeks is rebirth on a different soil. Novak travels around the world, clearly running away from something. Towards the end of the book, her answer is that she ran away from coming to terms with the fact that she could no longer be a Zionist. She struggled because she couldn't know who she is without Zionism. It is a supremely self-centered position. The most important thing for Novak is to feel good about who she is. Everyone else be damned. In Novak's world, there is no history and there are no others. It is all about her, how she feels, and what is happening now. By the end of the book, Novak has left behind her earthy Zionism with all its contradictions. Like a spiritual born again, she is ready to embrace some vague utopia of individual equality and democracy, unmoored from any sense of history and people. Like many utopians before her, Novak is very good at the noble task of destroying what exists, and clueless at building something new. There is probably no more anti-Zionist mindset, not in the sense of being opposed to Zionism, but in negating its very spirit. The genius of Zionism was that it had a vision for building something and went about realizing. Zionism didn't just tear down, although its thinkers had plenty of harsh criticism, not least of which about Jewish life in the diaspora. Zionism was very specific about what it sought to build and how it planned to go about building it and had the ruthless determination that came with it. From inception, Zionism had thoughtful and fierce detractors who mounted thoughtful critiques. With Novak, we now have soft navel gazers whose only concern is how anything makes them feel. One could only be nostalgic for the days when Zionism had more formidable foes.
Einat, thank you so much for reading this essay. There is no silence to be broken on the occupation because it explains and it makes clear to so many Jews what they've been thinking, what they've been suspecting about the anti-Zionist movement, particularly the Jewish anti-Zionist movement. And on that note, my first question is, you know, Breaking the Silence isn't the only iteration of something that I call, but not just me, many people have called the I was lied to at summer camp dynamic, which is I grew up with some, and it, Israeli and non-Israeli, I grew up with some truth accepted narrative about Zionism, about Israel. And then came the moment when I realized that there was some more gray to that black and white truth. I realized that some facts had been not necessarily concealed from me, or they believed that they were concealed from them, but were just out there and you just had to go look at and learn about and read about and talk to people about. There was that moment. And since I hit this moment where I realized I was lied to at summer camp, I have had this reawakening, this transformation. Now I'm a moral person. Now I can see the evils and the flaws of the Jewish community. And that always goes hand in hand with wanting to dissolve the Jewish state or any idea of Jewish sovereignty, because it never really worked out for anyone. Why is this narrative so powerful? More powerful, of course, for non-Israelis, for American Jews who grew up like me, who grew up going to a summer camp where we loved Israel, we celebrated Israel. And of course, the more complicated parts of Israel weren't discussed, not because they were trying to hide anything from us, but because we were 7, 8, 9 years old. And that's a little bit young to talk about, you know, Area A, B, and C and the, you know, the drama of Oslo and the different wars and everything. But why is it so intoxicating that now there's a movie about it, Israelism, where protagonist Simone Zimmerman, who was one of the founders of the American organization, If Not Now, which can be described as I was lied to at summer camp, the organization, whereas Israelism can be I was lied to at summer camp, the movie. I assume it's similar. I have not read Who Do You Think You Are by Yuli Novak, but I assume the similarities between Novak and Zimmerman are similar, and people are hailing it. You know, Peter Beinart, who's a great example of this dynamic, are hailing it as, oh, it needs to be seen in every synagogue and every community center. It is intoxicating for many young Jews overseas to go along with this description of how their lives have been handled for them. They've been abused almost by the Jews. And I'm wondering if you could provide some detail.
So I have to say, and it comes out in the essay, in the critique of the book here, is there is something deeply, deeply childish about it and not grown up at all. I wish it were, as you describe, okay, I grew up, I realized that things that I learned as a kid were, you know, there's more nuance. That's an actual growing up process. But what happens is actually a replacement with this, again, black and white dynamic, good versus evil, I see and you are all blind. There's almost a spiritual element in here that says, I am shedding this earthly body and I am now pure spirit. Not for me, this lowly life of contradictions, policy choices, difficult alternatives. There is this desire for purity, and being Jewish, especially in this era, is messy. It's earthly. It involves governing a state. It involves making difficult choices. And there is almost a primal desire to shed anything that has to do with living on this earth, especially as a Jew. The burden of it is something that throughout history, people sought to shed, to leave behind and replace with this pure, spiritual, essentially non-Jewish existence.
So to that point, it's almost not about the Palestinians really at all.
Oh, of course not.
Rather about the Jewish experience and about the Jewish condition and how I get to go to sleep, you know, and have a clear conscience about being Jewish rather than, because that's what it is. I mean, all of this Beinartian, I was lied to at summer camp, It seems very pointed against the majority Jewish community rather than in the service of actually making the lives of Palestinians better on the ground where the Palestinians actually are. It's very much an inter-Jewish debate conversation having very little to do with that.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And this, so this is why I talked about this, like, navel gazing. I mean, right. This is really what, and I'm sure you experience it in the various movements and the various discourses, there's something very not adult about it.
Right.
Something that doesn't actually come to terms with living in this world and making choices in this world.
Which is why it's ultimately very successful, or more successful, or only successful in the diaspora rather than in Israel. And that is a nice segue to my second question. So
I will just say this. Yeah. You've almost helped me realize that it's just a continuation of summer camp. They just still want to be in summer camp, just a different one.
At the dining hall where we had conversations about Jewish identity and Jewish future and Jewish history where no one really else was included. And like you mentioned in the book, she doesn't talk about what the Palestinians say or what the Palestinians want. They're an afterthought, even though the world that she has constructed, she wants us to believe is entirely in service to the Palestinians, which is just not true. It's all has to do with us. It's all about us. Very interesting. So I went on a Breaking the Silence trip to Hebron, or to the southern Hebron Hills, where the Palestinian villages of Yatta and Masafer are. And it was obviously a very depressing trip. It goes without saying that everyone on the bus was non-Israeli, was visiting from Canada. And I hadn't made Aliyah, so I was at that time only American as well. And it was a very depressing, horrible trip. I always hate going into the West Bank because this is not a good, I mean, I don't have any of the, oh, look at, you know, Judea, where Jews come from. Isn't this wonderful? We can connect with the soil and drink wine and, you know, talk about the spirituality of it. I'd say it sucks. It sucks that there is barbed wire and that there's communities living next to each other with different forms of government. And, you know, there's settlement violence and then Palestinian violence and vice versa. And, you know, on the ride back, the Breaking the Silence the Breaking the Silence officials clearly wanted us all to accept the narrative that this was unsustainable, tragic, and it needed to end now. And everyone on the bus said, yes, amen. And that was the main takeaway from the trip. They were all supposed to go home and tell their communities, Israel is occupying the Palestinian West Bank and it's immoral, it's illegal, it needs to end now. I was the only one on the bus who said, and then what? What happens? Let's say, yes, we do it because this is sad. Everyone can agree that this is sad. The occupation ends. And then what? What happens to this land? What happens to Israel? What happens to the Palestinians? Nobody gave me an answer. Nobody since then, that was over 2 years ago, and I am in contact with the same people, have been able to give me an answer. And I was thinking, you know, you style yourselves activists in the Israeli political scene. Have you really never had to answer this question before? And why do you think that is? Why do you think there is such an aversion to that question of, okay, let's say the silence is broken, and then what? There is no constructive vision, point blank, that happens after that grand finality of breaking the silence and ending the occupation?
Oh, certainly. It's, first of all, this nowism and everything now. You know, in Israel, we have a movement called Peace Now. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe after 56, 57 years, you might reconsider the name of the movement. Maybe long-term peace might actually get you there sooner rather than later. But I remember the first time that I encountered, if not now. And by the way, I always like the fact that they take snippets from Jewish sayings and ignore the rest, right? So if not now, but then if I'm only for myself, who am I? Right. Completely throws away the notion that you're part of something bigger, but fine. If not now. And I encountered them and they were like, they want to end the occupation now. And I remember it brought to mind those slogans from the 80s Lose weight now, ask me how. They had those stickers, bumper stickers. And I want to think about those terms. End the occupation now, and I want to have a slow, like a sticker, ask me how.
Don't ask me how.
Like, you know, I mean, sure, I want to end the occupation now. Can we just talk about how to do it? Can we talk about the fact that every effort Israel made, first of all, not to have an occupation, remember literally begging Hussein not to enter the Six-Day War, which he tragically entered, really kind of following the charismatic Nasser. But first, we very much tried not to have the war and not to be in control of the West Bank and Gaza. And once we were in control, numerous efforts to end it always met with Palestinians walking away, because for Palestinians, the issue was never the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, but from the river to the sea. So this notion of now that is entirely divorced from any understanding of the situation, any assignment of agency to the Palestinians, I mean, God forbid they will actually have to come to terms with the Palestinians as agents of history who know what they're fighting for, who are taking actions, and who have an ideology that they deeply believe in, that the Jews should not have their state anywhere between the river and the sea. I mean, give them the respect that this is their ideology. They're willing to fight and sacrifice for that. They have been very consistent in making decisions based on that ideology. At least respect that.
Right. And, you know, I think that this explains very well why anti-occupation organizations in Israel and in the West almost always ended anti-Zionism, which is really tragic because, you know, I got to college and I immediately became involved in J Street U because I thought that this was a Zionist organization that was for two states and it was pro-Israel, but also willing to do whatever necessary to make sure that, you know, there were two states, then Israel wasn't indefinitely occupying the West Bank. But the same thing happened when I went to the J Street conference in the spring of, I think it was 2019. The theme of that conference was end the occupation, and not a single one of the students there, many of who I was friendly with, of my peers who had come from around the country, of the speakers, of the panelists, of the very important executives of J Street who gave their keynote address, in a two-day event, gave an explanation as to how we end the occupation and what happens after we end the occupation. Not one. And now what you see, and I don't want to say this about J Street Big, but what you absolutely see about J Street U is if an anti-occupation organization refuses to place any of the blame on the Palestinian side, the only alternative is anti-Zionism. That's the only logical conclusion that they can come to. Because if they did accept Palestinian agency, they would realize that this current situation is not all Israel's fault and that demands need to be made on the Palestinians as well. And you can't have that because then...
oh, no.
Because then the what we talked about in the first question, the emotional aspect of it, the spiritual aspect of it, of throwing the Jews under the bus and liberating yourselves from the Jewish consensus opinion, that falls apart. And so if not now, no longer has any support. If not now, it's not even hiding anymore. They're blatantly anti-Zionist, not just anti-occupation. J Street U, I think in another 5 years, is not going to be a Zionist body. And I would even argue that right now they're drifting away rather quickly. And you have organizations like Omdim Beyachad in Israel who claim to be anti-occupation, but once you dig a little, you realize that it's actually quite anti-Zionist because they're unwilling to give the Palestinians any agency and just say, oh, well then, you know, the easier thing to do is to just, you know, one state from the river to the sea, everyone has equal rights. So it's very, very, very frustrating, I would have to say. What do you think is it going to take for the anti-occupation left in Israel and in Jewish communities around the world to finally understand this? Because it wasn't October 7th, like some of us thought it might have been, to finally understand that in order for there to be a two-state solution, in order for the occupation to end, there needs to be concessions on the Palestinian side. It's not completely up to us. What is it going to take? The political failure has already happened. The left collapse after Oslo. I don't even need to tell you the merits and labor polling averages right now. And violence didn't work. So what is it going to take for them to realize in order to be viable, we need to have a solution where both sides have to give?
So you're making the assumption, again, that this is an honest, good faith effort to solve a political problem. And I think, again, going through the book, everything we've discussed, this goes to very different places that have to do with how people deal with being Jewish in this world. So if people don't want to see, they're not going to see. And we saw it with Gaza, like we saw with long before October 7th, Israel got out of Gaza, and I was very much involved in that with the disengagement in 2005, precisely because we wanted to end the occupation now. And we realized after 2000, when Arafat walks away from an opportunity to end the occupation, to have a Palestinian state, the Israeli military retreats, he walks away from that, follows it up with a 3-4 year campaign of mass violence and massacres. And Israelis, I remember my feeling at the time. I was like, we can't allow the Palestinians to have a veto if and how we end the occupation. We want to end the occupation now. So if they're not going to say yes,
we have to force them to
have a
state.
We have to force them. This is what you're seeing now with leaders saying we're going to recognize a Palestinian state. I'm like, you can't force the Palestinians to want something they've never wanted, which is a state for themselves next to a Jewish state. They've always wanted no Jewish state as a top priority. So we wanted to get out. We were like, you know what? We're not giving the Palestinians veto. If they keep walking away from proposals to end the occupation, we're just going to end the occupation regardless of what they tell us. Right. No, we're going to force them to end the occupation, Sandy. We're just going to get out. And that was the idea. We're getting out of Gaza. The idea was to follow it up with getting out of the West Bank. We got out completely. I was part of those discussions. We took out the settlers. We took out the military. We got out of the Philadelphia corridor, the border with Egypt. We took out the actual buildings. We took out the gravestones. We took out everything. We took out the graves, the bodies. The thinking was, we're not going to leave them one tiny little excuse to say that they're still occupied. What do? They turn away and they say, we're still occupied. And a lot of Israelis are like, you know what? Then this is really not a serious discussion about policies. But this was a clear moment where Israel took policy precisely to end the occupation now, only to realize that the Palestinians are damn serious about from the river to the sea. They view owning Gaza as a wonderful opportunity to turn it into a massively fortified launch pad from which to, in their mind, liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. So this is precisely what you described. The moment after we end the occupation, what actually happens? They continue their century-long war against the Jewish state, and they continue to claim they're still being occupied.
Right. So let's throw them a bone to finish with and say, you're right. It's unsustainable, the occupation, at least. Even the blockade around Gaza might be unsustainable, obviously, because of what happened on October 7th. These aren't lands where human rights are flourishing. And it's a mess, a violent mess, a legal mess. And to be honest, I don't know why anybody in their right minds would want to live in a place where you can't even wait at a bus stop for fear of being shot or like sniped by someone on a hill like Schindler's List, which is what I learned about when I toured the area north of Jerusalem in the West Bank a couple weeks ago. Or when, you know, you can't even drive on the same road because cars are constantly trying to crash and veer each other off the road in front of checkpoints. So let's say them a bone and say, fine, it's unsustainable. We hate it. Our solution then, because we have to have a solution if they don't, is what? To actually put steps, to actually put pen to paper and have achievable steps to make this better, keeping in mind that we can't force the Palestinians to end the occupation if they don't want to.
So, first of all, I mean, I think we need to reconsider the notion of sustainability, of solutions, the notion that things are just clear cut and then you end them. This is not how human life works. This is not how history works. Things never end. Things are not resolved. They transmute, they change. I personally tend to propose Israel determining its final borders while continuing to militarily control the West Bank, and now we might even need to consider Gaza, until the Palestinians end their century-long war against the existence of a Jewish state in any part of the land. I think to the extent that we continue the military occupation, which is important to say, military occupations are legal. People think it's illegal. They're actually the legal means by which you control territory acquired in war until the future of that territory is agreed upon in peace. So we have, as long as the Arabs of this land continue their century-long war against the existence of a Jewish state in any part of the land, a military occupation is perfectly legal and justified. I personally think that it doesn't need to come with settlements. So this is why I propose, and I refer to it here, the idea of yes to the occupation, no to the settlements. I think it's important for Israel to determine its final border and to sustain it with what I call an active occupation, not the passive one that we have one, that we have now, an active one that essentially tries to end the war, to end the century-long Arab war against Jewish self-determination, that does not allow for organizations like UNRWA to continue fueling that war, that actually tries to bring it to a close. That is the direction that I would like Israel to go.
So an occupation that is working to finish...
to make itself unnecessary, exactly.
Right. An occupation that is working to make itself unnecessary, but which understands that that choice is not ours to make.
That choice is ours to make among very bad choices, and it's a choice we're making in, I think, the rational thought that it is the least bad.
But I mean, not ours to make in the sense of where when we do end this occupation, it's not going to be, it's not our responsibility to end this occupation. Yes, we put steps, we take steps to dismantle UNRWA and to foreclose upon any Israeli indulgence of the right of return or the idea that the Palestinians are going to flood into sovereign Israel. But at the end of the day, it is up to you to give up this 100-year war against Zionism, and only then will the occupation end.
Precisely. And alternatively, if the Palestinians believe, as they believe, that the state of Israel is a temporary aberration in the region, I'm not ruling out. They might be proven right one day, you know, maybe 200 years from now, they will look back and they say, we waited them out. You know, we used some advanced AI and now they're all dead. And look, it was right of us to wait them out. But we need to understand that both peoples here are making choices based on their goals. The Jews are making a choice based on their desire to have a Jewish state, and the Arabs are making choices based on their vision of no Jewish state.
Right, right. I guess may the best vision win. Thank you so much, Einat. Always
Thank
a great
you.
Conversation.
Ma shehu mitorer, ma shehu mitorer.